This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Joe Prendergast on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, I hope your Thursday's going well. Good to have you tuned in right around Western Australia. The country's telecommunication ombudsman has sifted through 27,000 complaints and it's found systemic and persistent issues in regional areas. Think things like the 3G shutoff and the impact that that's continuing to have on connectivity. Now the ombudsman has made some pretty significant recommendations for the telco industry, so I'll take you through those shortly. And last night, Richard Hudson took one for the team and tuned into the entire rail safety debate in Parliament. Shortly, you'll find out if he thinks we're a step closer to having safer trains and crossings here in WA. And before one this afternoon, we'll have all the details of the Mount Barker cattle sale. Well, the Australian grains industry's production average has increased by nearly 50% over the past 5 years, from 44 million tonnes in 2020 to now sit at 64 million tonnes per annum. Now, that's one of the findings in the Grain Growers 2026 State of the Australian Grain Industry Report. That report is compiled every 5 years and it looks at things like data and identifies trends, risks and also opportunities for the grain sector. Zach Whale is the General Manager of Policy and Advocacy with Grain Growers and he says the volume increase reflects some pretty serious productivity gains.
What a fabulous news story for Australian grain producers. It is a really big increase. We don't see the hectares change significantly. There's a little bit of change in that, but this is really a productivity story. And I would say we are just growing more and more with the hectares that we have available. And that's a really good trend that we've seen over the last little while. It's not one thing. There's lots of things behind it. There's grower ingenuity and there's how we've tailored our farming system in a very regional specific way. And similarly, how have we been able to access better plant genetics and better varieties that are able to grow more with less. So I think it's multiple things, but the proof's in the pudding and there's some really, really good numbers there.
So a number of factors that have really allowed that productivity gain. How much of a role do you think tech has played here in that real development that we've seen in the tech space over the past 10 years?
Look, it can't be understated. I think we have had, you know, Australia is a hostile farming environment. Our inputs are always expensive and have to be carefully managed. We've seen a no or low-till revolution over the years. We've seen lots of little changes. And this is not necessarily just in the last 10 years, but we've seen a revolution in how we farm over the last few decades. And now we're seeing the icing on the cake, which is improved genetics that let us grow more with the resources we have. And it's a really interesting point when people think back to previous generations. We sometimes have such limited moisture in the paddock and our grandparents couldn't even fathom planting a crop. Yet we do plant a crop and sometimes they're really good. And we've actually seen 5 record years in the last 6. So it has been a really positive growth period.
Is there a ceiling that we have now reached, Zach, do you think? Or can that 64 million tonnes per annum, which is the current production average, can that grow even further?
Look, I think a geneticist would have a different answer to that, and I'm sure farmers have their own views too. I mean, there is a limit to how much we can grow, but similarly, we don't know what we don't know yet. And I think our research sector will keep trying to push that ceiling higher and farmers will keep trying to optimise how they do what they do. And maybe that number can't double, but look, history tells us that we just get better and better over time. And especially when we have such a strong research backing, that really helps us as well.
This Grain Growers State of the Australian Grain Industry Report happens every 5 years, basically looking at what the industry has done, current trends and future trends. Is there, though, an increase in value that we've seen along with that increase in volume? Because volume sounds great, but what about the numbers underpinning it?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think sometimes the headline value numbers look good. If you asked a farmer today what's actually happening in the paddock, they would probably have a different answer. And what I mean by that is we've seen our margins corrode. We see input price pressure really acutely. In March, we saw diesel prices go through the roof. We saw nitrogen-based fertilizer skyrocket, yet we don't see grain prices tracking up in the same way. So I think the value numbers are strong. I think, you know, there is high value. That doesn't necessarily mean farmers are getting more and more and more each year. So it's important that we keep driving productivity growth. It's important that we try to extract as much value out of the paddock as we can. But we're also going to have to look at and really keenly look at the input price equation here to make sure that our margins don't keep deteriorating, because if they do, that's going to be a really hard proposition. So we do have to look at higher value crops. We have to look at things like oil seeds. We have to look at value adding opportunities in Australia, and low carbon liquid fuels is going to be an opportunity there so that we can keep that value going up. But not only that, make sure that the growers can capture a decent portion of the pie.
And on those shrinking margins that you mentioned, are you seeing, when you look at overall crop trends, a change in what's actually going in the ground in the paddock? I think of wheat in WA, we've seen a reduction in the amount of hectares going in. Is that being reflected nationally?
Yes, it absolutely is. I mean, wheat is still the major grain crop or crop grown in Australia, and it has been, you know, since Federation, but its share has definitely decreased. We've seen, you know, probably first, you know, barley really ate away at wheat's market share. We've seen oil seeds, in particular canola, really increase. And that's a high value crop. It's well suited to lots of farming systems, especially in the West. So canola has increased over time. And then we've seen pulses and things like chickpeas and lentils increase over time as well. So yes, the diversity of our crop mix is changing, and some of that's driven by agronomic considerations. But also some of those crops are higher value crops. And so, you know, they are grown well alongside cereals, and they give farmers options and hopefully derive even more value as well, as you say.
How difficult is it when you're thinking about the time period that this report was carried out over? You would have been on the tail end of COVID, and then you've got this conflict in the Middle East. So there were some really significant price shocks around inputs, which you've touched on, which also impacted the industry. Do you think you've actually got a bit of a normal-ish snapshot here, Zach, or is it hard to kind of get some really normal context around that?
Absolutely. The five-year interval is a really interesting one. The last 5 years was underscored with a trade crisis with China, which really impacted our barley market, and obviously Western Australia was heavily impacted by that. We also had the Indian market put tariffs on chickpeas, which were booming in sort of 2016, 17, and we had COVID, which just completely disrupted the world. We've had Russia and Ukraine and a crisis in the Black Sea, which changed grain markets significantly. And as you say, as writing was well underway with this report, we had a Middle East crisis, which highlighted to us the fragility of our supply chain and the challenge with being at the end of it. There's nothing sort of more scary than being at the end of a very long supply chain when everyone's vying for the same things that we need. So, yeah, I think that is interesting. A lot happens in 5 years, and you can also get record-breaking years, and then you can also get droughts, and you can also get floods. So the five-year interval makes it interesting. I think the Middle East and the supply chain shocks will probably be one of the major considerations of this five-year interval. But I also go back to that five record-breaking years out of six. That is extraordinary. But then there were farmers in Western Victoria and South Australia who had some really trying seasons there. So their experience isn't necessarily reflected in those national numbers either, because they did it really tough. And then other producers that just had eye-watering yields year after year. So that's the challenge with such a big country with such regional diversity in farming. And then I think just the other thing I'd note is when you see, you know, 44 million tonnes as a five-year average changing to 64 million tonnes, what does that mean for our supply chain? So obviously, if you look at WA, that's a great example. We've seen a really big uptick in investment in the supply chain to rise to that challenge. But we have to look at our supply chain nationally and make sure that we are efficient enough to move the grain to where it needs to go so that we can export quickly and capture that counter-cyclical window with North American or European production so that we're capitalising on those international markets. So there's a big freight component to this. The more we produce, the bigger the freight task. And there's also that resilient piece. So if our supply chains aren't resilient and can't handle the shocks that the climate throws at them, that's going to have a big impact on not only growers in getting their grains to markets, but also how efficiently we move grain through the system.
And Zach, you touched on canola and the low carbon liquid fuels market. Is that another growth area you think that farmers should be considering or really looking at?
I think farmers have been excited by the opportunity for a long time because we currently export canola for other countries. Biofuel and biodiesel markets. So I think the irony is we've been producing this fabulous feedstock for some time, but we generally send it to the EU. Again, March has underscored for us that we don't have enough domestic capability here. Why aren't we crushing and refining this oil here in Australia to put more fuel into the Australian system, also to stimulate regional development and jobs and economic value? And a bit of market diversity. So we are heavy in quite a few markets. There's some giant markets that buy a lot of our grain from us. So we don't have as much market diversity as we'd like. And again, with oilseeds, we've historically been very heavy in the EU market. So to have a domestic market for our oilseeds is only upside for Australian growers, plus the added benefit of having some more fuel security and some resilience and some domestic manufacturing capability and local jobs, the canola opportunity for low carbon liquid fuels here in Australia and definitely in the West is really exciting.
So really depending on how much investment and development happens of that domestic fuel market, that would really potentially change the numbers in your next report in terms of the size and the value of that canola crop.
Oh, absolutely. And I would expect if that can happen, I would love to see our export volumes for canola be a lot lower or be a lot more competitive and there'd be a much more buoyant domestic market to keep that grain here.
Zach Whale, General Manager of Policy and Advocacy with Grain Growers, just going through that 2026 State of the Australian Grain Industry report. It will be interesting, won't it, what the next five-yearly report looks like. Will there be a domestic biofuel canola market by the time that report is written within the next 5 years? Time shall tell. 17 past 12, always good to hear from you too. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, the text number 0448 922 604. Just pop your name and where you are on that text as well. Staff at a Kimberley cattle station are battling an out-of-control blaze that was suspiciously lit yesterday. The Department of Fire and Emergency Services says the fire at Anna Plain station is one of seven suspiciously lit between Halls Creek and Broome since Monday. David Stoat runs the station and says they're trying to contain the fire through some backburning, but the weather conditions are not great.
We're just doing a bit of back burning and grading and keeping an eye on it and, just putting a bit of water on spot fires where we can and, just trying to keep it under control as best we can, which is quite difficult in these conditions.
What are the conditions? Is it windy?
Yeah, look, it's much less windy today, fortunately, than yesterday. Yesterday was an absolute shocker, but there is still enough of an easterly breeze to fan the flames. So, it's not great conditions, but, yes, they're better than yesterday, fortunately.
Mm. When did you become aware of the fire yesterday?
We had a few calls from truck drivers yesterday morning, first thing, so... And by the time we got out to the highway, it was already out of control. And, it was just, it unfortunately already got away. So it's just a matter of trying to contain it now as best we can.
It sounds like it spread really quickly. Was it one fire to begin with, do you think, or more?
I think it was only one fire that got away from here, from us on Anna Plains. But, there were certainly other fires lit up and down the highway, which wasn't very nice.
Yeah. DFES said there were 7 suspiciously lit fires north of Halls Creek and south of Broome in 36 hours. So is it your understanding that the fire on your property was one of those suspiciously lit fires?
Yeah, it would be. It was certainly, I mean, when they start on the highway and there's no lightning strike or anything else that could have got it going, you're fairly confident of what's happened. So, yeah, I suspect it's the same person just, you know, running amok on a very windy day.
Is there any way to know who might have lit this fire?
Oh, well, it's a police matter, so hopefully they will investigate it thoroughly. So, there are cameras on the highway, as I understand it, so that might give them some intelligence. So, look, hopefully they can hold someone to account for this, because it'll end up costing us a lot of resources. And, hopefully someone can be held responsible.
Speaking of those resources, how are you actually fighting this fire? I know it's fire season now, and I imagine everyone at the station has just had to drop what they're doing to pitch in and fight this. But what kind of equipment do you have and what resources are you using at the moment?
Yeah, it's just sort of graders and loaders to try and get some fire, and strengthen the fire breaks, back burning and using the fire equipment to put out spot fires where we can. So, it's just station resources fighting it. So, we can't do any other work. So, that's what we're doing at the minute.
Is it currently the fire, is it far from your homestead and infrastructure?
Yeah, look, it's about, 15 k's north of the homestead, so that's not under threat at this stage. And, we should be able to pull up before it gets there, anywhere near the, there are other yards and fences and what have you, so it's just a matter of protecting them as best we can.
And livestock or cattle, they're not at risk right now?
No, they're pretty smart and get out of the way in events like this. So, it's just hopefully we can protect enough pasture for them, so they should be fine.
David Stoke from Anna Plains Station speaking with Jess Baker, hopefully having a win trying to get that fire out or under control at Anna Plains before it burns through too much feed. It is fire season, but it's also tourist season. If you are on the road, particularly north of Broome, along that Great Northern Highway, it is well worth keeping an eye on the Emergency WA website or keeping across the app, because there's a number of fires burning near the highway. All of them now are not at a serious warning level, but they are there, so keep an eye out. 22 past 12, heading towards regional news and weather at 12:30. But the Telecommunication Industry Ombudsman is recommending, and I quote, a root and branch review into the regulatory framework that telcos operate under. Now, that recommendation comes after a report analysing 27,000 complaints found systemic and persistent issues in regional areas. The Ombudsman, Cynthia Gobent, says the report shows regional Australians are often being left behind because of where they live.
Losing connectivity isn't just an inconvenience. It can mean that they're unable to call for help in an emergency, stay connected for the purposes of their farming equipment or just the internet generally, and stay in touch with families. We did also see that less choice actually means greater risk. Sometimes the challenge is that there isn't coverage, but often it's just that there isn't choice. So when a service fails, there isn't someone else to fall back to, or an affordable option to fall back on. And, that leaves people vulnerable to service failures, technology changes and rising costs.
And what about the impact of 3G? What's been the ongoing impact there?
We are still hearing, for many rural, regional and remote consumers, a level of frustration. They've been told that things wouldn't change. That's not their lived experience. They absolutely have experienced that the coverage that they had before isn't as reliable. We've heard examples where people had invested a significant amount of money in technology that meant that they were relying on 3G. That's not going to work for them anymore. Alternatively, in order to access 4G, they're having to, again, invest in antennas and things like that. This is causing a lot of frustration.
I noticed in the report there was a couple of examples of people not able to access 4G and 5G, even if they upgrade their technology, and having to revert to older forms of technology as well.
Yeah, we absolutely have heard from some consumers who have gone back to UHF radios, for example, just to make sure that they can continue to have a reliable way of communicating with other people. You know, that's not something we expected to see, people moving back onto UHF radio because they didn't feel they could rely on mobile services. But, you know, I think there's a quote in there that someone says they feel like they've gone back to the 60s. I grew up in rural Australia and UHF was what we did, but that was, you know, 35 years ago. It's not what you expect in 2026.
And what are the key recommendations that have come out of this report?
So the overarching recommendation is that we think there needs to be a root and branch review of the regulatory framework. What we have seen over time is important improvements in the regulatory settings, important improvements in consumer protections, but they are being just tacked on to the existing framework. And we have seen such significant developments in terms of technological innovation and changing market developments. It's not fair on the industry and it's not fair on consumers that we're still sitting with the same regulatory framework. It isn't producing good outcomes for either. So that for us is one of the key things that we're calling on the government to do. But there are plenty of recommendations that are focused more on what telcos could be doing differently. For example, timely access to technicians, looking at how they ask for people to verify their identification, for example. The rules allow a level of flexibility. Let's not make it hard. So there are a variety of different things aimed at government regulators and the industry that would actually improve the experience for regional, rural and remote consumers.
There has been a swathe of reports produced by ACCC, Senate committees, independent panels over the last decades. I have read stacks and stacks and stacks of them. Most of them have been ignored, quite frankly. There are some things in there like temporary disaster roaming, UIMO that are happening, but broadly they kind of just collect dust. And I've spoken to many consumers, advocates and experts that just want action on what we already have. What would another review really achieve? Would this just kick the can down the road?
Absolutely not the time to be kicking the can down the road. I think one of the key things is there is some really good content in those reviews and reports that you mentioned, things that haven't been actioned, that if actioned in a really sensible, not piecemeal, but really sensible way, would deliver improved outcomes for rural, regional and remote consumers.
Telecommunications Ombudsman Cynthia Gobent speaking with Lauren Pezzett. I was out in the Murchison for a few days just recently and I was really surprised actually at where I could send a text now, and that's based off the satellite connectivity. So you could text but you certainly couldn't call from many places, and to try and access data I had to hack into, well not hack but you know, borrowed someone's Starlink because you just there was no data. So interesting, that review coming after 27,000 complaints about telecommunication and connectivity in Australia. Heading towards regional news headlines and some weather for you shortly, but every year young people from across the country flock to stations in WA's north, and they do that to build skills, have an adventure, experience the outback, and also gain some independence. And drinking culture has historically also been a strong part of life on many cattle stations. But Pilbara pastoralist Mark Bettini says that's changing.
Well, I think in the early days, alcohol was quite a big problem in our crew. Like, and I won't pretend that I wasn't taking part in it. And I think when I was between 21 to sort of 27, I think, you know, I wasn't a heavy drinker, but there was a bit of a an assumption that if you did drink, you would get up and go to work. Whereas I'm looking at our crew nowadays, and they're a lot less inclined to do that. Yeah, they'll have a beer or two during the week, but, you know, we don't have any problems with anyone turning up with a hangover. It's good to see.
What do you put that shift in workers' drinking habits down to? What's the reason for that, do you think?
I'm not exactly sure. Perhaps it's to do with, you know, younger people now are sort of, I don't know whether education has done something good for them, but they're less inclined to really hit the alcohol hard. I mean, it's not going to be the same everywhere, but certainly our staff are very responsible. Yeah, there's not a big drinking culture there.
Drinking on a station, do you think the attraction there for young people is maybe they're isolated and there are less things to do, or maybe they're young and it might be their first time away from home? What do you think is the attraction there as someone who has worked on stations for a really long time?
I think when you are working long hours and you come back and you're tired, sometimes a beer becomes a real attraction. And then when you're normally having beer on a social occasion on the weekend, and then all of a sudden it becomes that, oh, I'll have a beer during the week, and then you're having a beer every day and then two or three beers every day. I think the attraction is in order to wind down from the day and to relax. But I think when you're using alcohol to relax, you're actually, it's very hard to get out of that habit. That's where I see it.
And I wonder as well, have you seen a link in the people around you between alcohol use and mental health?
I'm not really sure if I'm the right one to comment on it, but I think if you're using alcohol to relax as your only method of relaxing, that's probably not a good thing. But, I mean, if you have other hobbies and other things you can do, you know, one of my things is ride horses, and I do that after work occasionally. So if you've got something else to relax with, read a book, that's probably more healthy than choosing a can of beer every night. At the end of the day, we want our staff to, I mean, we don't want them to not enjoy themselves. We want them all to have fun, but we want them to be able to work safely. We just want to promote a safe workplace. And for me, the last, I guess, 10 years, I've just seen a dramatic improvement in, you know, young 17, 18, 19-year-olds coming into the workforce and having good habits to start with. So whatever's happening out there is great. And it gives me a lot of hope and enthusiasm that the industry is going to be safe and strong and probably will have a lot better leadership from those guys coming through.
To Grey Station Manager Mark Bettini speaking with Jess Baker. If this topic interests you, you can read more about it online. Just search ABC and rural drinking. You should find that story there. Let's head to the newsroom where we find Jonathan Hopper. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Nationals leader Matt Canavan says he doesn't want to see any reductions to working holiday visas after a shadow cabinet colleague suggested cutting them. Liberal frontbencher Andrew Bragg has told the National Press Club a modest reduction in international students, working holiday makers and post-study visas should be considered to bring down net migration. Parts of the Great Northern Highway have been closed in the Kimberley region in response to an uncontained bushfire. Access to the highway between Bidjidanga and the Roebuck Roadhouse is now closed as the fire burns west towards the road. A bushfire advice is in place for people at Barnhill Caravan Park and Barnhill Station. And Telstra boss Vicky Brady has defended the telco's executive salaries after she received an 11% pay rise. Telstra slashed more than 1,200 jobs in the last financial year and had an outage on July the 8th that affected millions of Australians. Its annual report shows Ms. Brady's salary rose by $600,000 to $6.8 million, but her bonus has been slashed by a similar amount due to the outage. Thank you, Joe.
Jonathan, thank you. Heading towards the Mount Barker cattle sale at 1 o'clock. It was a pretty small sale today. Not too many buyers, only about 500 or so sold. And I hear quality was pretty mixed. So just before one, Tracy Kilner will run through what some of those prices were like. But Angeline Prasad is at the Bureau to run through the weather for the next few days. Angeline, let's kick off in the Southwest Land Division again. How are things looking for the next few days?
Good afternoon, Joe. The pattern is static, so not much change in the weather pattern over the next few days. We are looking at sunny days. The ridge is going to be the dominant weather pattern until at least Sunday. However, it is shifted a little bit closer to the south coast. So the winds over the next few days, it's going to be more from the east to northeasterly direction. And we're forecasting a slight increase in the overnight temperatures. If you look at overnight minimum temperatures last night, it was quite cold again, with large areas through the Great Southern, the Central Wheat Belt, falling below 0 degrees. So we're forecasting the temperatures to be up by 1 or 2 degrees tonight, but a lot of overnight minimum temperatures can be dependent on a lot of factors, such as clear skies, light winds. And I expect the winds to become light again, and there will obviously be clear skies tonight. So I have a suspicion that the temperatures again will be quite cold tonight. So getting close to 0 degrees across large parts of the Southwest Land Division, and at least through the southern parts of the Central Wheat Belt, south of about Mukunbuddin, Wongan Hills, these areas are likely to see quite cold temperatures sort of below that 3 degrees. And that basically increases the risk of frost. Formation of frost is also dependent on a lot of factors, light winds, clear skies, but also the slope of the land, how quickly the temperatures drop off overnight, and also whether your land is in a valley or hill, or over a hill. So I expect that a risk of frost will occur again tonight, especially through the areas I've mentioned, south of over the southern parts of the Central Wheat Belt and the Great Southern, and maybe inland parts of the Southwest District, so through the Boyer Brook, Bridgetown area, and also through the Esperance region around Ravensthorpe and to the west of Salmon Gans. Over the next couple of days heading into the weekend, it will start to feel spring-like because the winds do turn more north to northeasterly, and this tends to bring in warmer temperatures, both daytime and overnight temperatures. Clear conditions will continue over the weekend under the ridge. However, the ridge will start to move east over the weekend, and hence the winds are going to turn more north to northeasterly, and that should help reduce the frost risk overnight. Temperatures will remain cold, but maybe rise above the 3 degree mark that is of concern when it comes to frost. So getting up above or close to 5 degrees, and that should help reduce the frost risk. We saw large areas of fog as well through the Southwest Land Division last night, and that'll continue tonight. But as the temperatures warm up and the northerly flow brings in a bit of drier air, that risk will ease over the weekend. Next week, we will see a series of cold fronts come through, so there will be a change in the weather pattern, so from a dry outlook for the next few days to a wet pattern. It's unclear how much rainfall we'll see with these cold fronts. It's a bit too early to sort of figure that out. The fronts at this stage, from what I'm looking at the guidance available to me, they look typical for this time of the year. So the moderate falls are more likely over the western, south and southern districts. Inland, with the first cold front, I expect at least 1 to 3 millimeters across much of the Central Wheat Belt and the Great Southern, which with the western areas sort of west of Wagin all the way out to northern, they might get a little bit more, maybe 5 to 10 millimeters. But early days yet, so that's the amount of rainfall on Monday. And then we'll see a bit of a respite in the weather on Tuesday, followed by a second cold front on Wednesday, and then most likely a third cold front on Friday. So stay tuned about how much rainfall we'll see with these fronts next week.
Okay, we'll watch them and hopefully warming things up a bit, Angeline. Some fires about in the north, some winds not helping. How yes. will the next few days pan out?
Well, we've seen quite windy conditions across the north the last few days with that southeasterly surge. Now, thankfully, the winds are going to ease from this afternoon. So tomorrow morning, there'll still be a bit of wind across the north interior, but the winds through the Kimberley and the Pilbara do ease off, and we get into a much more warmer easterly flow for the remainder of the week. We have got a trough that is developing over the Kimberley that will extend into the Pilbara tonight, and that will help bring about a bit of an increase in humidity. But also tonight and into early tomorrow, we'll see a cloud band develop through the Kimberley and the interior. So we're forecasting some patchy light rainfall for the western Kimberley initially tomorrow. It's not going to be much in the gauge, but you will see cloudy skies and also patchy rainfall here and there. It's unseasonal for this time of the year, so that should help mitigate the risk of fire over the next couple of days. In terms of how much rainfall, maybe just 1 or 2 millimeters in the rain gauge. If it does happen, it's going to be sporadic here and there. It's really the interior that we'll see sort of more of what the cloud band will produce. So places around Warburton, Giles, Carnegie, they will get to see a little bit more rainfall. That's where we're predicting chance of thunderstorms tomorrow and into Saturday. They could see 5 to 10 millimeters. So the more moderate falls are likely through the central parts of the interior, whereas through the Kimberley and the remainder of the interior, the northern parts and the southern parts, we'll only see just a couple of millimetres. But that cloud band will help to mitigate the fire risk over the next couple of days. The cloud band does contract eastwards on by Sunday, so there is clearer weather on the way. That easterly flow remains, though, until the end of the week. The trough that I have mentioned does move inland on Monday across the Pilbara and the Kimberley into the interior, and we'll see a southerly change through, but there might be another cloud band developing over the over parts of the Pilbara next week. It's a bit early to talk about that, but there looks like there will be another cloud band through the northwest and central parts of the state.
Angeline, thank you. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too.
Richard Hudson, you've been busy all morning counting up the rainfall. What's been happening?
Yeah, in the last 24 hours up until 9 a.m. today, nowhere in WA recorded any rain at all, as far as I'm aware.
Okay, so hopefully some coming next week by the sounds of things. But this morning you said that you spent most of yesterday afternoon watching a live stream on your phone. What was it? Was it the Dockers training session, a Nat Fife highlight reel? What was it?
No, Joe, a live stream. Nat Fife, it wouldn't have been a live one, would it?
Oh,
no.
Whoopsies.
No, it was the rail safety bill being debated in Parliament. This is the one that we talked about on yesterday's show. So this is the bill that was submitted by Nationals WA leader Shane Love with the intention of making trains and crossings safer.
So on that, I was listening this morning and it said the debate was adjourned last night. So does that mean that things will just get booted down the road again?
Yes and no. Yes, because this is obviously not the end of the road or the line in this case. And so we don't yet have a final new document that legislates details for better train safety going forward in WA. But in my opinion, this debate was significant for a number of reasons. First up, there will be an outcome soon. That's pretty certain. We will have safer trains and crossings soon, and that's a good thing. All sides are just sorting out the detail, basically. There are lots of reasons why this has taken so long and why it's frustrated the campaigners behind the scenes, like Lara Jensen, who we heard from on yesterday's show. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons is the Labor Party wanted a national approach to all of this, and you can understand why. They wanted consistency across the country. The problem was WA is leading the way on proposing some of these improvements. So as Libs member for VAS, Libby Medham, said last night in the debate, to get anything sorted nationally could take years. So she and others were asking, why can't WA take the lead? So at the end of last night's debate, Deputy Premier and State Transport Minister Rita Saffiotti acknowledged that maybe it is time for WA to go it alone on this.
I do want to say on the outset, state governments sign many intergovernmental agreements, national agreements in which we adopt nationally standard policy measures. Those, in this case, were adopted in 2012 and 2015, where in 2012 we adopted the Rail Safety National Law, and then in 2015 we also passed the National Law and Mirror Legislation. So as a state, what happens is you sign up to national laws, national agreements. And of course, normally you wouldn't want to depart from those because the whole intention is to have nationally consistent standards, but I acknowledge that people have been waiting a very long time to achieve a result when it comes to train lighting, and that's why when the leader of the National Party brought in the legislation, I came here, listened to the second reading speech, and as a government, and as a, we have been considering that legislation. So I'll say at the outset, this is not normal in which a government will depart from a national law that we've signed up to. So, number one, so this is not a normal thing. But understanding the seriousness, the gravity and the patience and the work undertaken by the advocates for many years, it is clear that more action needs to be taken, and it needs to be taken quicker than potentially the national roadmap. So I'll say that from the outset. I'm not sure what ramifications there are going to be for our government in pursuing this, but this is something that I think is very important.
Deputy Premier and WA Transport Minister Rita Saffiotti speaking in Parliament at the end of last night's debate on rail safety. And she also just talked about how about $84 million has already been spent or allocated to improve the safety of our rail crossings. So that's got to be a step in the right direction as well.
And Richard, debates sometimes in Parliament start becoming point scoring exercises and can get a bit heated. How did this one go?
It wasn't like that at all. And I suppose that's the second important takeaway from this debate last night. Everyone from all sides of politics were pretty much on the same side, on the same page with what they want to achieve. And that's better rail safety for the future to prevent accidents and deaths. So there really was bipartisan support. Members for different parts of WA from different political parties spoke. They all explained why better rail safety is important for their constituents in their area. And they all spoke with a lot of passion and empathy for those who have lost loved ones. Some of those family members were actually in the Legislative Assembly last night.
And you mentioned yesterday that you'd been chatting to someone from the union. Is that why these rail safety improvements are taking so long?
Sort of. It's one of the reasons. Josh Takaya represents the RTBU, so that's the Rail, Tram and Bus Industry Union. And he's admitted he basically wanted WA Labor, the party, to reject the bill that had been put forth by the Nationals. That's partly because he was a bit miffed because he says Shane Love had not properly consulted with him and his union or with the rail operators or, importantly, with the regulator before submitting the original Rail Safety National Law Application Amendment Bill on June the 10th. So Josh says his union doesn't actually have a problem with the aim of the bill, what it's trying to achieve. Again, that's for just better rail safety. It was just some of the detail neglected to take into account some important nuances associated with trains, carriages, drivers and massive distances here in WA. But I texted him while I was watching last night's debate. He happened to be watching the whole thing as well. Two dorks weren't actually sitting next to each other, but we're both watching it away. But what we noticed, what unravelled was some amendments have already been made to the bill. So here's a little of what Josh Takaya had to say on today's morning show when asked if he's happy with those amendments.
Well, what we wanted was for the government to stand firm and defeat the bill, if I'm being honest. That was our request. And what we wanted them to do was to continue to work with us and community to improve level crossing safety.
Yeah, but this is also, but this is about safety. Yep. This is what people can't understand is like cars have lights, trucks have lights, just get on with it and put lights on trains. People are just finding it hard to understand the resistance, I guess.
Well, trains have lights. But to answer your question more specifically, we're willing to compromise as well, and we are pleased with what the amendments were put forward. We're also pleased that the Nationals listened to us in relation to fines for train drivers, in relation to amber beacon that would need to be seen in all directions, despite the fact that they would be on the front of a train. So you obviously couldn't see it from all directions. So there was some significant drafting issues with the bill that we raised with the Nationals, and I think they heard us and they put through some of their own amendments. But we're very pleased that the Labor government heard our concerns, considered our concerns, and in most circumstances implemented those concerns through their amendments. So and I want to congratulate Lara as well, by the way, because advocacy for her and her family and the other families. We're advocates too. We've been advocating for train lighting, for level crossing safety. We've been pushing through for the new standards to have improved improved lighting and improved visibility. We believe that that's been achieved through the amendments.
Josh Takaya from the Rail, Tram and Bus Industry Union speaking to Nadia Mitsopoulos on today's morning show. And I actually chatted with Josh again this morning and he said, they just didn't want to get stuck with legislation that may have had unintended consequences for drivers and rail companies and possibly the public as well. He also said it's important to note the Nationals have amended their own bill. That's after follow-up consultation with the relevant parties, including the union. And he said if the Nationals accept the amendments that have been made by Labor, this bill could actually go through pretty quickly. He's still very keen for the governments to put more effort into education of road users or drivers, you and me, about safety at rail crossings. In other words, making the point they need to take more responsibility at crossings. It shouldn't be solely left up to the train drivers and train companies. And I think that's partly why they haven't fully supported the original bill from the start. But have a listen to what Nationals member for Albany, Scott Leary, had to say last night on the topic of drivers and rail crossings in his area.
This is not a bill about building new infrastructure at level crossings. It doesn't talk about asking for a single boom gate, a single flashing light, a flashing tower, a single dollar of taxpayers' money being spent on a crossing itself. What it asks is much narrower and much cheaper. That the train switches its own lights on. Visibility down both flanks, visible from 200 metres out, and a rotating beacon on the front. Visible from half a kilometre, running for the last kilometre of approach to every crossing. The obligation sits with the operator, not with the crossing. That distinction matters because it means this reform can happen fast, and it means the excuse of it's too expensive to fix every crossing in the state simply doesn't apply here. We are not fixing every crossing, we are making sure every train can be seen. That distinction matters enormously to the electorate I represent. Great Southern is grain country, and running through the middle of it is a working railway line hauling nothing but grain. One that winds its ways past the Stirling Ranges, past the Porongarups, and through the outlying settlements of Mount Barker, Cranbrook and Redmond as it makes its way down to the port. I want to be precise about that because people sometimes assume that every train line still carries passengers. It doesn't. Every unit of rolling stock on that line is moving grain from the receival bins scattered across the Great Southern down to the export terminal at the Port of Albany. For about 10 to 11 months of the year, that line moves quietly through the background of daily life. Then harvest comes, and for a few short, intense months, everything changes at once. As the outlying bins along that line fill up, loaded trains down to Albany are more often, and those trains are at their heaviest and slowest to stop at all hours, day and night. At exactly the same time, those same roads and those same crossings are carrying a wall of harvest traffic that simply isn't there the rest of the year. Headers shifting between paddocks, utes, a steady stream of grain trucks, road trains, B-doubles, carting to the very same receival bins. A fair few of them contractors working long hours on roads they don't know anywhere as well as the locals do. So for a few months a year, it isn't just more trains on the line. It's those trains at their heaviest, running more often, at the same time as the trucks that feed them are converging on the same crossings, often in the dark. And that's exactly the moment that this bill is built for.
Member for Albany, Scott Leary, who represents the Nationals, speaking in Parliament during last night's rail safety bill debate.
Richard, it was interesting to hear union rep Josh Dekaya acknowledge all the hard work that's been done by rail safety campaigner Lara Jensen.
Yeah, and he was not alone. And without any form of exaggeration at all, every single speaker last night, yesterday afternoon and last night, acknowledged the tireless campaigning efforts of Lara Jensen. They also acknowledged the people who were in the debate upstairs who were representing the various families, as I said, who'd lost loved ones. But if you'd like to hear the story of Lara Jensen, just go to the podcast for yesterday's Country Hour. Joe, one last point on this debate. WA Transport Minister Rita Saffioti was very complimentary of CBH for the way it's handling lighting on its new locomotives and retrofitting its old stock. It was almost embarrassingly complimentary. She must have mentioned them four or five times. I think that's partly because she was recently invited to go and have a look at their new locos at night, and she was pretty impressed with how well lit up they are, way more lit up than the old locos. Kate Forrester is going to have a look at some of CBH's new locos tomorrow morning, and then she'll be presenting tomorrow's Country Hour. So, yeah, sorry to give you the news on air, but you're not on air tomorrow. You're dropped. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm going to give you some news. Kate's stuck in Broome. Her plane's been delayed 7 hours.
That's not going to stop her. She can drive. Just take care on the crossings, Kate.
Might need to be a bit nicer, Richard. Thank you. Appreciate all of that. On yesterday's Country Hour, you heard 10-year-old in the Great Southern who shared his experience crashing into a herd of cows that were on the road. Hervic Declarador was heading east to Albany. He was on the South Coast Highway when he came around a corner and hit at least 15 head of cattle that were in the middle of the road. He had a lovely new four-wheel drive. It's been written off completely, but really he was lucky to walk away from that crash. Great Southern Police Superintendent John Munday says the cattle had escaped their paddock due to a broken fence.
We got the report that a car had hit some cows, and the guys went out there and yes, there were sort of in the vicinity of 30 to 50 cows around on the road, wandering around. My briefing is that four cows had been killed outright by the initial impact, and there are three cows that needed to be euthanised, so they were euthanised by police. We did some initial inquiries. The rangers were contacted. The City of Albany, City of Albany rangers were contacted. And it turns out, from what I've been briefed, is that the fence was down in that area through to a fallen tree that night, I presume, which unfortunately allowed quite a large number of cows to get out on the road. So we were called back there again the following morning about 7:30. Where cows were still on the road. The officers then counted six dead cows, so we're assuming they were the ones from the night before. We haven't really cross-referenced that sort of data, but obviously City of Albany have been out there and the rangers have made their determinations of what they need to do, and we sort of leave it with them deep herd, you know, it falls squarely in them. We respond to the aftermath of these incidences, but they're extremely dangerous, and there's been multiple occurrences where there's been fatalities and serious injuries where cars have hit sort of any sort of livestock, native animal, etc. on the road. So, yeah, pretty harrowing experience by the sounds of it for that driver.
Have you managed to speak to the farmer whose cows own the cows?
No, at this point, no, look, at the end of the day, that's a matter for the City of Albany and potentially Deep Herd, I suppose. But there's some pretty pretty stringent regulations and responsibilities that pastoralists and farmers or any property owner has really about keeping their animals enclosed and whether they'd have reasonable condition and maintenance of their fences and whatnot. So look, that I'm sure that will be being looked at by the relevant authorities, and yeah, time will tell whether there's any liability back to the farmer at all, but sounds like it's just a series of events that have led to a tragic accident for the cows and fortunately no injury to people.
Great Southern Police Superintendent John Munday speaking to Andrew Collins. The City of Albany has confirmed it's investigating the incident. If you'd like to see what that lovely car now looks like, just search ABC Cow Car Crash and you'll see the story. Some incredible pictures there. Speaking of cattle, it was a small sale at Mount Barker today. Only about 500 head sold, down about 360 on last week. Tracy Kilner has all the prices for you.
A mixed quality yarding with lighter weights offered in the younger cattle. A small gallery of buyers were selective on types, with prices trending down in most categories. Good numbers of yearling steers and heifers sold to feeder buyers, while restockers took all the lightweight calves on offer. A small selection of heavy slaughter cattle were down, with processor demand easing 10 to 20 cents this week. The weaner steers weighing over 280 kilos sold at 520 to 550 cents, while the lighter weights made from 512 to 578 cents. Weaner heifers weighing over 330 kilos made 462 cents. Weights over 280 kilos sold from 412 to 462, and lightweights sold from 404 to 470 cents a kilo. The yearling steers sold to feeder buyers from 494 to 552 cents, while yearling heifers eased, returning 446 to 482 cents a kilo. Grown heifers were down, with weights under 540 kilos making 360 cents, and the heavier weights selling from 360 up to 380 cents a kilo. Heavyweight cows sold from 270 to 320 cents, and store cows made from 252 to 260 cents a kilo. Heavy bulls sold from 230 up to 330 cents, while another large yarding of lightweight bullies returned 320 to 424 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thank you. Going through all the details there of that Mount Barker sale, 498 head sold. Down significantly, down 361 head on last week. Don't forget, if you've missed any of the stories in today's program, you can go back and listen to the podcast. It'll be available in about an hour or so. Just jump on the ABC Listen app and search for WA Country Hour, and that'll take you to the latest program if you've missed any of today's stories or you'd like to even listen again. Thanks for your company. I'll talk to you again soon. It's news time now. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.